Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Hooten. The Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Thank you. Five in an oral calendar today. The case is A21-0237, McGann versus Claiborne et al. I see. So, Ms. Gilstrap, you will be arguing for respondents. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And is it Ms. Cruz you were arguing for the appellant?
My apologies, Your Honor. This room, this is the name of our conference room that is appearing in the bottom of my Zoom screen. My name is Katie Marie Connolly, Nyland okay. Johnson Lewis, on behalf of appellant Amana McGann.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Connolly. That makes sense now for what our records show. Thank you. Excellent. Okay. As you likely both know, you each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And each of you, I'd ask in your principal arguments that you start with your name and the party you represent for the record. So you know this is being recorded. So we are ready to proceed with counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Katie M. Connolly, and I represent appellant Amana McGann Incorporated. This appeal concerns the complete dismissal of a non-compete dispute between Amana McGann and four of its former employees. In this appeal, appellant raises three issues. The first issue on appeal is very straightforward. Can a Minnesota court determine the reasonableness of a restrictive covenant agreement in the absence of a factual record when current precedent requires reasonableness determinations must be made on a case's facts in addition to the contractual language? The second issue on appeal concerns whether the duty of good faith and fair dealing applies to post-employment restrictive covenants. The third issue is a procedural one. Whether appellant raised the issue of treating respondent's motion to dismiss as a partial motion to dismiss because respondents did not challenge certain claims raised in the complaint, and if appellant did raise the issue, did the district court consider it? I could recite the facts as required by the Minnesota appellate rules. Would the court care for such a recitation?
I don't think so, unless I see a nod from anyone. I think we're probably familiar with facts. I guess I want to begin with the first argument, the idea that there can never be a dismissal. Let's assume that there is a restrictive covenant that says for 40 years, former employees shall work nowhere in any job whatsoever. I mean, what facts do you need to determine whether that's reasonable or unreasonable? The rule seems to be that you're advocating is nope, you better get some facts out before you decide whether that's a reasonable restrictive covenant.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that's not the case that we have here. While I think there certainly are cases in which a court could determine that there's no set of facts under which a covenant could be reasonable, that's just not what we have here. We don't have a situation in which any of the agreements at issue prohibited an employee from working at any job period for any employer for 40 years.
Well, I think the question then is whether if we look at 5C, which is I think what we should be looking at, but I want to get into that, is whether the, you know, in any capacity, directly or indirectly, is sort of the equivalent to that, whether that actually does, one could look at that and say as a matter of law, that's just simply unreasonable. It's unreasonably broad.
So then I think what we have to do is go back to Bennett. So in Bennett, that case, Supreme Court case, included the same in any capacity language. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Minnesota did not determine that the agreement was per se unreasonable. So what the court instead determined was that in analyzing a restrictive covenant, you have to analyze the surrounding facts and circumstances. And that is necessarily, as other courts have determined, a fact-specific inquiry, unless you have the extraordinary circumstances that Your Honor earlier identified. In other words, similar to what the court found in Gaviris, you simply have an agreement which under no circumstances could be enforceable. I'll give you an example.
Let me ask you this. The Rule 12 lens, in fact, assumes that all the facts you've alleged in your complaint are true. I mean, to me, that seems, you know, in Bennett, you had conflicting evidence that the district or that the Supreme Court said, you know, you need to have a trial on that. But here, didn't the district court rightly assume all the facts? And don't we, because we're reviewing de novo, rightly just assume all the facts you've alleged in your complaint to be true?
Your Honor, that is the correct standard. The problem.
So why wouldn't we be in a position then to evaluate the language of the non-compete agreement provisions and the facts as alleged and make a decision about whether, as a matter of law, the facts as alleged by you show that this non-compete is reasonable?
Because they're in addition to assuming that all the facts as alleged are true, all inferences must also be construed in the appellant's favor. In this case, the pleading party, and that didn't happen because the test that must be applied to the enforceability of a non-compete agreement requires that facts and circumstances be evaluated, and those facts and circumstances, it's our position, weren't evaluated on the court's the court's dismissal here.
What inference from the facts that you alleged is not taken in your favor by the district court?
The court determined as a matter of law that in any capacity agreement can never be enforced, and that there is no...
Well, that's a legal question. What inference from the facts that you alleged that was not given, treated favorably to you? What factual inference from the facts you alleged?
I think on that issue, the facts that were not taken as true related to the fact that certain assurances, that the assurances clause could be construed in our favor as a further limitation. I think principally the issue here, though, is what you have identified, which is that as a matter of law, the court determined that a contract which includes in any capacity limitation is per se unenforceable. And there simply is no Minnesota precedent binding this court to affirm on that ground.
Let me ask you the converse, I guess, of that. Is there any precedential case that has in fact found that a non-compete clause with the breadth of 5C here is in fact valid and enforceable?
Yes. So we have cited in our brief a number of cases in which contracts with similar language have been found to be enforceable. And so that is the issue that we have here, because because you must look at the facts and circumstances of each case, there are circumstances in which an in any capacity agreement could be enforceable.
Can I ask you this? Because if I take your argument to its logical extension, anytime an employer enters into one of these agreements, there's really no downside to making it as broad as possible and to use this broad language that was used here, if in fact you can argue, well, it may be broad, but this is in this particular case, it's okay. I mean, does that sound like the result that we want in these type of cases where an employer is basically, by operation of law, encouraged to make it as broad as possible so the courts can clean it up in retrospect?
I think that is the law of the state of Minnesota.
So that if an employer says, once you work here, you can't work anywhere, anytime, you're just done with work. That would be the extreme. That your argument would be, well, as long as they show that they're a competitor or they're, you know, that it's the same type of job, it's still an enforceable provision. Is that your argument? Because otherwise, I don't know why any employer would ever do anything reasonable.
Your Honor, that isn't my argument. My argument is that under Minnesota law, partial restraints of trade are enforceable. Total restraints, like the one that you just described, are unenforceable. So Minnesota employers upholding the law of Bennett v. Storrs doesn't allow for employers, or nor does it encourage employers to use a total restraint of trade like the one that you just described. Instead, what it requires is a partial restraint, which is precisely the language that we have here.
Now, let's look at the language then and just focus on what makes it reasonable in your view. We're not bound up. We can look at this language here, so we don't need to deal right now with what the district court decided. But if we look at 5C, will not render services to any competitor or customer directly or indirectly in any capacity.
And Your Honor,
I have questions about, a customer is someone who presumably buys the product of Mono. It could be, I suppose, a municipality or someone else who has a parking place, right? Or a mall. Why?
No.
What is reasonable about precluding someone from rendering services to a customer of the business indirectly? How is that a reasonable restriction?
2 points on this, Your Honor. You skipped over the in the business qualifying language, which is very important. So this is not, first of all, a prohibition on working for any customer, period. It's a customer operating in the business.
Right. And what does that mean? That's confusing to me. A competitor in a business, I understand. It's someone who sells the same product and competes against you. What is a customer in a business? Isn't that just someone who buys the product of your business?
Not necessarily. A customer could also operate in the business. So a customer could both purchase from you and operate in the same business as you.
You mean be a competitor?
Yes.
So a customer you're reading to be equivalent to a competitor?
It could be. But this is the issue, Your Honor, that we're missing here. We have no factual record. So what the court has essentially decided here on no facts is that this is impossible to enforce. However,
isn't the record here, according to your complaint, that in fact Flash Parking is a competitor? So we're dealing with the world of a competitor for whom these four individual respondents have gone to work. Correct.
Yes. So the scenarios or the hypotheticals that we're discussing and which the respondents have focused on are hypotheticals. So it's a red herring in my view, because the issue is not whether we are trying to prohibit these individuals from working for 40 years for the Gap, because the Gap has a parking garage. That's not what's at issue in this case. And what Bennett requires is that we analyze each of these scenarios under the facts of the particular case. And in this case, each of these individuals have gone to work for what no one in this case disputes is a direct competitor, not a customer.
Right. Aren't you in effect, though? I mean, if we proceed in this way, aren't you in effect asking the court to basically take what the court might deem to be an unreasonable provision and reforming it and limiting it to the facts? Isn't that exactly what you're asking?
Well, no.
So the court is in the position of basically having to limit it and rewrite it.
First of all, under Minnesota law, courts are entitled to reform or blue pencil or modify contracts. So certainly there is a long, long, long history within Minnesota to do exactly what you've described. Now, again, the policy considerations at issue there are not before this court, because there is Supreme Court precedent allowing for this. And if the legislature, which they have done in many other states, opted to prohibit blue penciling or modification, the legislature certainly could do that. But they have not done so here. So in other words, we are bound with the law that we have, which requires not only factual analysis to be applied to each case, but also allows a court to modify an agreement. On another point there, Your Honor, this contract specifically allows for severability. So it it permits on the party's agreement to have a court strike provisions that it felt are not enforceable or to the extent they would be enforceable. So to the extent the party or the respondents complain about directly or indirectly or in any capacity, those are provisions which could be stricken or modified by the parties' agreements. The parties specifically agreed that could happen.
So you will agree that under your scenario that you are asking the court to basically blue pencil this provision so that it is, you know, restricted to the particular factual scenario.
At the Rule 12 stage, all I'm asking is that our client be permitted to proceed with litigating its case. Whether the court ultimately decides to do what Your Honor has just described is at the court's discretion. Mm-hmm. However, we're at the Rule 12 pleading stage. And so all we're asking is for the ability to litigate this case on its facts. And we believe we're entitled to do that because there is no precedent mandating that an agreement of this type is per se unreasonable and unenforceable. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time and I'll reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Great. You will have 5 minutes. Thank you. Ms. Gilstrap.
You're not, you're muted.
May it please the court and greetings from Austin. I'd like to start by reminding the court of the Rule 12 standard applicable here. And that is if it's not possible on any evidence which might be produced consistent with the pleader's theory to grant relief, the relief demanded, then the claim should be dismissed. And what you haven't heard today or read anywhere in any of the briefs before you is a single example of any evidence that could possibly change the overbreadth of the language of these non-competes. And I think the court's questions really honed in on that problem with the appellant's case. And I'm sorry, my name is Leslie Gilstrap, and I do represent the respondents for the record. I apologize for that.
Just as a starting point, Ms. Gilstrap, are you in agreement that the complaint alleges that Amano has legitimate business interest for seeking the protections for confidential information and the non-compete agreements?
I believe that non-competes in general can protect protectable interests of a business, such as goodwill. In this case, the problem is that the agreement is not reasonable on its face.
Well, can I ask you this? Because I understand, you know, your argument that this is overly broad and it's unreasonable on its face. But, I mean, we have a whole host of cases in Minnesota where the court has basically found that a two-year durational time for the non-compete is unreasonable, and the court will blue pencil and say, well, no, we think it's 1 year based upon an evidentiary hearing or based upon arguments made by counsel. And also with regard to the geographical location, there's been a blue penciling of that. What about the argument here that this is just another way of blue penciling the agreement?
All right. Yes, I think that's a really good question. And we outlined that the response to that in our brief starting on page 20 in the respondent's brief. All of those cases are distinguishable, Your Honor, because they all dealt with the reasonableness of the duration of the agreement or the geographic scope. And in footnote 7, you can see that we've gone through each of the cases that were cited by the appellants. And in our parenthetical, we refer the court to so you can easily find that those cases were constraining the reasonableness of the geographic scope and duration. And I agree, if that were an issue here, we would need to have a factual record, but that's not the issue here. Here, what's unique is that it's the scope of the restricted activity itself. It's that language that's overly broad. And there is no case cited by the respondents in which the court looked at that issue head on when that issue was challenged And they said that, oh, no, we have to have a factual record to decide that issue. And there are,
here's what's bothering me is, and I just want to follow up on the appellant's argument. I mean, we clearly have case law in Minnesota that district courts can modify the agreement to make it reasonable. We clearly have that case law. Now, granted, I don't know of a case, and maybe you do, where they've hit head on that, you know, they aren't going to blue pencil when we're talking about the type of job. And I think the description that you gave is if someone goes and gets a job as a janitor in one of these competitors, that they shouldn't be prohibited from doing that. Why is the appellant not correct that you can basically blue pencil this provision so that it meets the needs of the parties to not compete and focus on the facts as to the particular job that's involved? In other words, is it a job that's a direct competitive job?
So I'd refer the court to our brief on pages 22 and 23. Minnesota courts have determined that while blue penciling a non-compete can be appropriate when the geographic scope or the duration is overly broad, it is inappropriate when the scope of restricted conduct is overly broad, since it would require the court to rewrite the agreement and divine the party's intent at the time of contracting. And there we've cited the Best v. Bothman case, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1977. That's a longstanding case here in the state. And Midwest Sign, which is a federal case applying Minnesota law where it collects cases. And in the Gavaris versus Green Spring Media case, which is also a federal court cited on 23 of our response, it specifically says this, that the courts would need to rewrite the agreement wholesale if a party were to ask it to blue pencil the scope of the restricted activity as opposed to geographic scope or duration. And that rewriting would require the court to, quote, divine the party's intent at the time of contracting.
Ms. Gilstrap, as you're moving forward with your argument, I want to clarify again. I think you agreed that the non-compete agreements reflect legitimate interests that Amano has in protecting confidential information and goodwill and those kinds of things, but that the issue in the case, as far as you're concerned, is the scope of the restriction on activity. I just want to make sure we're talking about 5C right now, correct?
Well,
you did not move in the district court to dismiss the claims against Mr. Dishman and Mr. Hennessy for violating 5B, correct?
That is not correct, Your Honor. We did, because if you look at the pleading, the complaint in this case, Amano applied 5C to all of the employees. They said that they all served in sales and non-sales capacities. And in our footnote 8 in our response brief, we address this issue. You're basically, what I think maybe you're positing is that it would be possible to blue pencil this agreement and apply just 5B to Dishman and Hennessy. And that would—
Why can't you? We're not blue penciling, we're severing. If we agree with, you know, if we were to agree that with you that 5C was too broad, that it restricts non-competitive activity and is therefore too broad, wouldn't we sever that and still wouldn't at least the two people who also did sales work, wouldn't they be subject to the 5B non-compete agreement?
Well, you'd be disregarding the appellant statement in their pleading that 5C applied to both of those two gentlemen. And so you'd be actually not applying the facts as they're supposed to be construed at the Rule 12 stage. But I think that you would, the idea is that these two people, according to the complaint, were hired in non-sales capacities. And so it was at the time of contracting, it was contemplated that 5C would be applying to them. And for you to blue pencil out 5C and say, well, Because that's overly broad, we're going to apply 5B. It would be both disregarding the factual allegations in the complaint and also seeking to divine the party's intent at the time of contracting.
Excuse me, go ahead. I'm sorry, one more question. Doesn't the complaint allege that Dishman and Hennessy worked in both a sales and a non-sales capacity, thus invoking both B and C?
Yes, they did, but C is the more restrictive covenant. And the idea is that when they were hired, it was contemplated under the appellant's facts in the complaint, it was contemplated that the more restrictive covenant would apply to these two gentlemen. That would be my answer.
My question was answered by that. So you can go ahead.
Well, one thing with my time left, I'd like to talk about the Bennett case. I think that it's important for the court to understand that in the first instance, Rule 12 was not considered at all in Bennett, whether or not you could have a blanket rule where evidence would always have to be considered at the Rule 12 stage was not considered in Bennett. And also, if you look at the language of that case, I think it's important to understand that throughout that case, the Bennett court was concerned about the employee and the employee's right to be able to make a living. And that's consistent with Minnesota's clear policy of disfavoring non-compete agreements, not favoring them as the policy posited by the appellant would have you do. In actuality, the Bennett court said that you cannot decide right off the bat without evidence that an agreement is enforceable against an employee. And I urge your honors to take a look at that case because that's an important difference. Here, the appellants have turned that around and said, no, you have to take evidence before you can find it unenforceable. Well, that contradicts Minnesota law. The Minnesota policy, which disfavors non-compete agreements, and it really is a misconstrual of the entire policy that is being promoted under Bennett. I think there are also a couple of issues to look at when you look at these non-compete agreements. There's not only the in any capacity language, what the Minnesota courts have called a janitor clause, that exists here. But as the district court, Judge Brewing pointed out, there's also a directly and indirectly clause in this. It prohibits the former employee from working indirectly or directly for a competitor. And as Judge Brewing stated, that would encompass, for example, taking a job with a utility company that provides electricity to competitors. How can that not be on its face unenforceable? And why can't a decision be made under Rule 12? As I've stated from the beginning, there simply hasn't been any evidence, and I didn't hear any today during argument. What is one example of one piece of evidence that changes the language of that agreement so that it is not overly broad? I wanted to talk briefly about the assurances clause, if your honors wanted me to address that. The assurances clause does not save the agreement from being overly broad. It basically says that if you come to Amano, ask us for permission, and if we want to, we'll waive your non-compete. That is not, that does not save the non-compete agreement from being overly broad. It just allows Amano to exercise its own discretion to waive the non-compete if it decides to do so. And one of the issues that appellants brings up is they say is that no, there is a covenant of good faith and fair dealing in Minnesota. And that requires Amano to consider a request like this in good faith. We point out in our brief, and we pointed out to Judge Brewing, this is an employment agreement, and generally the covenants of good faith are not applicable to those types of agreements. But even if they were, Amano's ability to exercise a contractual right would never be a breach of the duty of good faith. And so therefore, if they just decided that they were going to waive this, or they were going to waive this provision, that could not be considered an act of bad faith. And therefore, the assurances clause doesn't save the agreement from being overly broad. And finally, there are three new cases. You know, we've had six sets of briefs between the parties filed in this case before the trial court and here. And for the first time, we had three cases listed in the reply brief that I wanted to briefly address and distinguish. Amano argues in its brief that those three cases that restricted activity included language that said that the person could not compete in any capacity. And therefore, those are some unique cases where the court said those agreements are unenforceable or are enforceable, even though they had any capacity language. In the Lifetime Fitness case, and the AVI system case, please read those cases. The scope of restricted activity was not challenged in those cases. And nevertheless, if you look at it, then the restricted activity was narrowed to specific activities, actual. It wasn't just any capacity. And in Nilfisk, contrary to the statement in Amano's reply, the court did not find the non-compete to be likely reasonable. To the contrary, the court explicitly stated that it was not opining on the reasonableness of the scope of that agreement. For these reasons, we ask that the court affirm the trial court's dismissal of Amano's claims. And thank you.
Thank you very much. And counsel for appellant. Sorry, the name threw me off for a second again. I got stuck on that cruise.
Ms.
Connolly.
You're not alone there, and it's an issue that we need to fix in our office. I only called Ms. Cruz on numerous occasions, but given the her artistry, I don't take offense at it. So,
all right, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to take a moment to draw our attention back to Bennett v. Storrs, because while the respondents would like to believe that there is a per se or a janitor rule here in Minnesota, there simply is not. There is in Texas, where I believe Ms. Gilstrap is office. There's a statute in Texas that actually requires a scope of activity. There are numerous other states in which a scope of activity restriction is part of the, it's mandated as part of the analysis. It isn't here. It is not in Minnesota.
And well, I ask you though, because we're talking about when the court can blue pencil and when the court can't blue pencil, and I'm noticing and I think it was referred to by the respondent, that it's one thing to blue pencil duration and geographic area. When you're getting into the scope of the agreement, apparently, there's case law that indicates that's where we draw the line. The court is not going to rewrite these agreements and try to figure out what the intention of the parties is. And there's a number of cases that she quoted are cited. How do you respond to those cases and that argument?
In two ways. First of all, what the primary issue that respondents have raised here is the inclusion of the in any capacity language. There is a severability clause in a provision in this contract, which respondents signed. They don't dispute that they signed it. They don't dispute that it was supported by consideration. They don't dispute that this is a provision in the agreement. That provision, which they willingly and knowingly agreed to, says that the provisions in this agreement can be modified to make them enforceable.
But how does severing that language help? It just means that it still fails to define the capacity of the new work. And the argument is you have just too broad a capacity of work. The courts aren't going to retrofit what they think is reasonable that the party should have agreed to as to the type of the work that employees can do. I don't really get severance as helping you.
So here's why I think it does help me, Your Honor, because the question goes back to Bennett. You have to analyze the agreements under the facts and circumstances of the case. And in the Bennett case, it was an in any capacity provision. And the court could have, but did not determine that that language was unenforceable as a matter of law.
And that's, do you have any case where the court has basically rewrote or blue penciled the scope of the non-compete provision?
Certainly there are a number of injunctions in which a court has entered a more limited injunction based on scope, but on this issue of in any capacity, there frankly isn't any case law supporting either party's position on the per se validity or invalidity. But there also isn't any requirement that this capacity or scope language be specifically included. And that's, again, where we go back to Bennett. What the court did not say is, in order for a non-compete agreement to be enforceable under Minnesota law, it must include a scope of activity. It didn't require that. It instead required a certain geographical and temporal restrictions, and then that the enforceability or validity of the agreement be analyzed under the facts and circumstances of each case. And so,
in this case, I don't think we're concerned about duration or geographic restriction. Right. We're concerned about, or your argument is that that the in any capacity is valid, that it meets your client's legitimate needs. My concern is that 5C, because it with the in any capacity language with no modifier about the particular business context, restricts more than competitive activity. And if that and on its face does so, seems to me that's a problem. And I have that for you to respond to. And if I could ask one more question, and that is, how do you respond to respondents' argument that at the time Dishman and Hennessy were hired, they were hired in non-sales positions, so they are thus only subject to 5C, and that we should deny your alternative argument that the 5B claims against them should have survived this motion to dismiss?
Well, first of all, they didn't move to dismiss on 5B. It wasn't analyzed by the court, despite it being preserved on appeal or in the district court. So that issue would require to be, that must be remanded, because it simply wasn't, they didn't move on that basis. So I answered your second question first. Now I'll turn to your first question. There is a limitation on the ability to work in 5C. So it is will not render services to any competitor or customer of employer in the business. So first of all, it's not just anyone. You have to be in the business, which of course is big B. That means there's a definition. And so there is both the temporal and the geographic restriction, which are required. And it restricts the ability to work for a competitor in this specific business, which is defined fairly narrowly. The respondents attempted to cut and parse through some words, but I think the definition of big B business is actually pretty narrow. And again, under the Bennett v. Storrs test, we have the exact same language. We have the exact same language. It's in any capacity. And I'll just turn back to that because I think it's very important. The Minnesota Supreme Court did not determine that this was facially invalid, even though it analyzed this language. The artist further agrees in covenants that upon termination of his employment with the company for any reason, he shall not directly or indirectly for a period of 18 months from the date that artist should cease to be employed by the company, accept employment from unrestricted or appear on or become financially interested in any radio or television station whose station offices or antenna is located within a radius of 35 miles of any city, et cetera, et cetera. That language is indistinguishable from the restriction that we have in this case.
Although wasn't the disputed issue in Bennett the temporal and geographic restrictions?
The disputed issue in that case was whether or not the former employer was justified in seeking to enforce the non-compete. So the court could have in that case determined that that they had no justification in seeking to enforce that agreement because it was facially overbroad. They did not.
Thank you. Thank you both. The case is submitted.